This episode is brought to you by Ronnie Sue's Chocolates, a confectioner in New York engaged in responsible cacao sourcing from the Toledo district of Belize. Check them out at ronisue.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
So this is Pauly Shore. I'm here in, is it Bushwick?
It's Bushwick.
Bushwick, and we're here at Roberta's, and we're on Heritage Radio. We're talking about food. We're talking about, big glasses, and we're talking about all the man buns, and you're listening to The Morning After.
Episode 182 of The Morning After. I am your host, Sari Kamen. Welcome, everyone, back to Heritage Radio. This is the world premiere episode of the fall 2016 season. I couldn't be more happy to be kicking off the season. I have one of my favorite chefs of all time, Alex Reich, in studio with me. Hi, Alex.
Hi, how are you?
Great. We were actually just in studio hanging with Pauly Shore. No big deal. That actually happened.
NBD.
NBD. He stopped by, so that happened. I don't know where to go from there.
I don't even know if we can go.
We still have an episode.
We're only down from there.
You certainly can't go up.
No.
That's for sure. So we'll try and keep it a level playing field. We have so much to talk about with Alex. All of her restaurants: Lavara, El Quinto Pino, Chiquito, the new one, Tecoa. Her cookbook. We will get to all of that. But first, of course, some food news. All right. So first off, a semi truck carrying hundreds of live chickens in Melbourne, Australia, recently landed or had a little accident and sadly crashed, I guess, in front of a KFC of all places. Thank you for that, David. Yeah, spilling literally hundreds of live chickens onto the doorsteps of KFC in Melbourne, Australia. And weirdly enough, a woman happened to be also in the pathway, and she had a cell phone and documented this, and she was a vegan. So yeah, this weird twist of fate happened where hundreds of live chickens fell in front of a KFC, a vegan videotaped it, and I don't know. I guess the joke is, like, they were probably going to end up there anyway.
Ba-dum-bum.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay, weird. Moving on from there, McDonald's. You don't usually think of fitness when you think of McDonald's. Recently, they tried in their Happy Meals to include a fitness tracker.
We actually went and bought the fitness trackers.
Well, did you know that they were recalled?
No, but my kids did not think they were fun.
I'm glad they didn't think they were fun, because they had to be recalled because they turned out to be really dangerous.
All these because people, of the battery.
I don't know. Yeah, like, all these people got burned from them and all these, like, weird rashes. So they had to recall all of the fitness trackers, which just goes to show McDonald's really has
I think we still have one in our car.
Oh, somewhere. No. Well, I think you can trade it in for, like, a yogurt.
Cool.
Yeah. Did you have a fitness tracker from McDonald's? Alex's daughter is here. They're bad for you because they give you a rash on your wrist. Which is, it's kind of funny because McDonald's is not really known for being very healthy. So they tried to do something that they thought would be more healthy, and it didn't work out really well. Okay, don't use yours. Okay, and, you know, we should acknowledge, of course, that today is 9/11, which is, you know, a very horrible and sad anniversary. Walmart did something really, really horrible. They tried to create a monument to the 9/11 memorial and anniversary by building the representation of the former Twin Towers out of Coca-Cola boxes with a big sign that said, "We will never forget."
You showed me the picture of this prior to the show.
I did. Twin Towers of Coca-Cola boxes with a huge
something
sign.
Something makes me think even Coca-Cola wouldn't be happy about that.
No, I don't think that they would. I mean, this isn't, like, funny to share. It's just, like, so horrifying.
Like,
that we had to share it.
Who,
like,
in their marketing department?
Like, Walmart, Coca-Cola, come on.
Like, who could have possibly signed off on this? Like,
I know.
And how did they get that job? I just don't understand.
I know. And I'm sorry to say, but, like, why did this have to happen in Florida? Like, Florida.
Oh, well, if it had to happen somewhere.
If it had to it wasn't Texas this time, it was Florida. Not cool. Yeah, not cool. All right, so that's our food news. We are going to take a quick break, and we will be back talking all things food with Chef Alex Reich.
Is brought to you by Ronnie Sue's Chocolates, the New York confectioner where chocolate begins at the source. Ronnie Sue's own direct trade chocolate is handcrafted in Belize, made with organic Mayan cacao.
We're making the chocolate down there, bean to bar, and we employ several folks, local folks, that have learned the craft of chocolate making, and we actually have a factory in Belize. When I say factory, I mean it's like this big. Kind of like, you know, Heritage Radio. We're almost in a shipping container.
Ronnie Sue loves to geek out about chocolate. Come to her atelier on the Lower East Side and get schooled. Sign up for a hands-on make-and-take chocolate truffle class and let Ronnie Sue show you how it's done. Stop by to watch the action in their open production kitchen and enjoy a few chocolates in the secret backyard garden. Take some confections home or shop online at ronisue.com.
Yeah. And we're back here listening to The Morning After on Heritage Radio Network. This is your host, Sari Kamen, in studio with Chef Alex Reich. And Alex, your daughter is here. Would you like to introduce her?
Yep, this is Minnie Mayan Montero.
She's say,
in the
say
house.
Hi?
In the house.
Hi. Welcome to Heritage Radio. She looks pretty cool. She's wearing some pretty big headphones. Earphones right now.
Yeah. Yeah. The size of her head.
Yeah.
Headphones the size of your head. It's so, like a burrito.
So, Alex, very happy you're here. You are the chef of many of my favorite restaurants in New York. I'm a little bit like fangirling out.
Thank you.
And you are a very busy lady as well. So you have your restaurants, Lavara, which is in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. and you have Chiquito and El Quinto Pino in Manhattan, and you have a new restaurant called Teca.
That's right.
Which is also in Brooklyn, and you have a new cookbook called The Basque Book.
Yeah.
And we will talk about all those things, but I want to sort of take it back because you're known for really bringing Spanish cuisine, like specifically Basque cuisine, to New York, to the masses. And you grew up in an Argentinian Jewish household in Minneapolis.
Yes.
What was that like?
It was great. It was the only thing I know, so I can't really compare it to anything else. But yeah, I grew up in it's a very secular Jewish house, so I wouldn't say, I mean, I never, I don't feel as Jewish even as probably my daughter, who's sitting right next to me, does, or I didn't as a child. Mm-hmm. I didn't really, like, you know, celebrate any holidays or anything, but I definitely grew up sort of with sort of the culture sort of in the background of my cultural, I don't know what you would call it. Cultural life, yes. Life is good, thanks. But very much, all the things that I assumed were Argentinian about me, it turned out a lot of them were Jewish about me. And I didn't know because
What do you mean by that?
I mean, I thought that the way that we ate was super Argentine. And then it turned out half of the things that we ate were very Argentine, which meant they were very Italian or very Spanish. And then the other half of the things that we ate were very Jewish, and like my parents' later of like intellectual life or their like sort of perspective was it was very Argentine immigrant because they were that, but then it was also sort of very standard Jewish. But I didn't realize
are there a lot of similarities in the two cultures, like just in the way that they eat?
No, No, the only thing that what's similar is, I mean, or what's unique in Argentina, rather, is that it's an immigrant country. So just like New York or many parts of the U.S., like there's a lot of different cultures feeding into the way that they ate, except for that it was like a very particular wave of immigration. So it was mostly Spanish, Italian, and German Jewish, with a little bit of English in there, and maybe some French. But like now, I'm sure that the landscape of Argentina is really different because there's probably all these other Latin American people who have been like flowing in there. So there's probably more like Ecuadorian stuff, mm-hmm. and like, I mean, it's probably changed a lot since my parents lived there. But at the time, it was a very sort of conservative, very European Latin American country.
Mm-hmm. I guess I meant not like the actual cuisine, but like the way in which they ate. Like, you know, coming from like an Ashkenazi European descendant Jewish family, my grandmother was like, there was so much food.
There's a lot of food.
Yeah, and it was like you had to finish what was on your plate or there was something wrong with you.
Yeah.
And even if we ate so much, she'd be like, eat more, eat more.
Yeah, there was definitely a lot of food, and we had friends would like sleep over and just couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
Like they would be like, they would have to go home instead of sleep over because they were so full. Or like it was, yeah. And it, you know, and my parents grew out of that in a way, but I think when I was younger, there was lots of food.
Yeah.
And then it became sort of a more intentional meal with a beginning and an end.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was young, it was just like there was no end. It would just go on forever.
Right. I remember going to friends' houses when I was younger who weren't Jewish and looking in their fridges and being like, your fridges are so empty. Like,
yeah.
What's wrong with your parents?
I never felt that. But, like, I remember, you know, I was a child of the 70s and 80s, I guess. And definitely, like, I had friends whose parents were, like, more that sort of American hippie where they were, like, making, like, nut loaf for dinner or, like, mm-hmm. lots of sort of baking and bran muffins and then very sort of middle America kind of fare, but then made healthy.
Yeah.
And, like, some of that, I love that kind of stuff now, but at the time I was just kind of, like, I can't really, we're having, like, sprouted oat loaf, like, for dinner.
So what did get you into cooking? I mean, I read that you said you always sort of pictured yourself in a restaurant.
I did. My parents took us to restaurants, and restaurants were, like, how we celebrated, but also how we were sort of normal. Like, it felt like everything that we did that was conventional or, like, I don't know, happy things happened to us in restaurants. I mean, when my mom would, like, when we played hooky, my mom would take us out to lunch at, like, our favorite little, like, Chinese-American place. Like, that was sort of, like, this, like, guilty, illicit thing that we would do. And that was, it would happen in a restaurant. And then, you know, my parents worked a lot, but on weekends we would, like, go to, you know, other ethnic restaurants. And those were, like, happy memories, and they happened in restaurants. Then we'd go back to Argentina and visit family. And we would, you know, we had a very small family. It was just us, you know, the five of us. When I was growing up, no cousins, no aunts, no extended family. But when we'd go to Argentina, there was extended family. There would be, like, 25 of us around a table at a restaurant because we couldn't really gather 25 people at a home or in someone's apartment. So restaurants were really happy places for me. And so I always played restaurants. And it wasn't just what was happening at the table. It was, like, sometimes what was happening under the table. Like, we would start out, you know, at the table eating, and then the parents would keep talking, or the adults would keep talking. The kids would be under the table playing.
I mean, do your children do that now? I mean, they've actually
they have
up in
done
restaurants.
It at my friend John's restaurant. I remember recently, and I remember seeing them do it and thinking, oh, that was us. But I think my kids are growing up really different than I did. I mean, they're growing up the way I wish that I would have grown up, and they probably are slightly resentful that they spend so much time in restaurants that for other reasons.
I don't know.
What do you think, Mayan? Like, I mean, we don't bring you to work as much as we used to anymore because our managers told us that we needed to stop.
Do you like hanging out in your mom's restaurants?
The one that I go to the most is probably the one in Brooklyn.
LaVara?
Yeah.
Is that your favorite?
I wouldn't say it's my favorite in food, but yeah.
Oh, okay. Do you have a favorite in food?
Yeah.
Which one?
El Quinto Piano.
It seems like you have a very sophisticated palate.
You can say that.
Okay. Do you have a favorite of your restaurants, Alex? I mean, I know that's probably hard to choose, like choosing your favorite child.
I do have a favorite, but I mean, are you supposed to say that? I read some article.
They're your restaurants.
Yeah, but it's not that it's my favorite restaurant to dine at, because I don't really make a habit of dining at my restaurants. I mean, I do it because I do it either accidentally because some friend of mine is coming in town, wants to eat, and I want to eat with them. And then I do it intentionally when I want to make sure things are on point.
Yeah.
And they're very different experiences. When I check in to make sure everything's on point, I'm usually like, oh, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong. And then when I just go with a friend, I'm like blown away sometimes, and it's just very fun.
Yeah.
My favorite place to be is Cheeky Dome. It's the biggest of the 3.5 that I have, and so I'm very comfortable there. I don't feel like I'm in the way of my staff. It's also where my office is, where I do a lot like of research and like writing stuff. And a lot of times, it's where I will like make a new dish and then I export it to the other restaurants. So I'm most at home there, and so there's the most sort of like crazy scrap material and like raw material to work with there. But I love going to Lavara a lot too, because Lavara has like the spice thing that doesn't live at Chiquito. You know, like Chiquito, I have every weird piece of the animal that I cut off and saved and froze until I had enough of them to make like a special for one night, and that's very spontaneous. And at Chiquito, I'm able to be more spontaneous. Also, Chiquito is very, because it's Basque, it's very modest and minimalist. And so I find it to be the most sort of quietly surprising food that we make. It's like it's the most elegant food that we make. But that, you know, it's not like these crazy bold strokes and flavors. It's like very subdued.
Yeah. So all of your restaurants have like a Spanish theme to them.
Except for Tacoa. Yeah, Tacoa's
okay. Yeah. I guess I didn't even quite realize that, having had gazpacho there recently,
exactly.
Which I loved. Two questions. First, like, since you're not Spanish, like, what was it that drew you to Spanish cuisine? Because it was before you even met your husband that you seemed to fall in love with it.
Well, I was in culinary school and I was reading a lot and I was kind of into outlier stuff. I mean, I know that now that's going to sound surprising, but nobody was really talking about Spain and nobody really knew Ferran Adrià, really, or very few people did. And I started reading, I mean, it was before the internet, really, so I was reading like more like food arts and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Mostly just sort of restaurant, I wouldn't call it gossip, but just whatever I could get my hands on that was current, that felt current. And I read about Abuyi and I wanted to go there. And so I think I just started, like, in my mind, I wanted to go to Spain. And so then I wanted to find somebody who would send me to Spain, because I didn't have enough money to just, like, go on my own and not get paid. And sort of in search of that opportunity, I took a job at a Spanish restaurant that was opening in New York, and that's how I met my husband, and I ended up falling in love with the traditional cuisine instead of the sort of vanguard stuff.
Instead of going to Spain, you kind of brought Spain to you.
Exactly. And also brought the opposite type of Spain. Like, I thought that I was really interested in this, like, sort of modern, and then the more I explored the traditional, I felt like I wanted to talk about that, or I felt very at home in it. I just understood it.
And what was the first restaurant that you opened in New York?
I opened restaurants for other people. The first restaurant that I opened for myself,
I mean, like, the first restaurant that you opened with Eater.
Oh, the first restaurant that we opened together.
Yeah.
It was, well, the first restaurant, our oldest restaurant is El Quinto Pino, but we actually, like, were not working at it. I had partners in that restaurant, and so we reopened it in 2009, so it kind of feels newer than Chiquito.
When I was born.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, so I guess I guess it's Chiquito, El Quinto. It was El Quinto Pino, Chiquito, then back to El Quinto Pino, then Lavara.
Oh, okay.
And then Tacoa.
And Lavara is very different because it's Spanish, but it also, but it's very specific. It's Moorish cuisine, is what I've heard you describe it as.
Yeah, I mean, Lavara is actually totally, it's a semi-improvisational restaurant, I would call it. And it is really about the intersection of, like, Moors and Jews in Spanish cuisine.
Yeah, so what was the inspiration? I mean, it feels so, like, such a specific and, like, very, not obscure, but, like...
Well, because it's not... I don't want to say it's an imaginary restaurant,
but it's kind of like, eaten there. It's a real restaurant.
It's kind of like Shangri-La, you know.
Yeah,
like it's
yeah.
like it's not medieval food, but what it is, and I mean, really, it was just about satisfying my own interests and like being able to be a little bit more free and playful, but still sort of give credit to the Jews and the Moors of Spain, and also. Shine a little light on stuff that I don't think that even Spaniards realize are the legacy mm-hmm. of these cultures that they sort of rejected and tortured into like becoming sort of this one sort of, it was actually in their rejection of these peoples that their cuisine came about. And so that was sort of like what I was noticing after living in Spanish food for so many years. Like, I would look at this and I'd be like, oh, that's very Jewish, or oh, that's very Middle Eastern, just because I'm that person who likes to eat at ethnic restaurants all the time, or like, you know, travel, and oh, that's like, that really reminds me of Turkey, or that reminds me of all this stuff. And then you'd look at it, these are like these long, like the national dishes of Spain are like clearly like, you know, Shabbat dishes. Hmm. But then they're polluted with all this pork, which makes them really great and makes me want to eat them more. So it's not that I don't like sort of vegetarian cooking. I do. I do a lot of it. I do a lot of vegetable cooking. But I think it's kind of cool to look at, you know, what happens to a Sabbath dish when people start putting, like, you know, pork face into it. And that's what Lavara is about. Lavara is really about... just looking at Spanish food sideways and pointing out, like, it was really about choosing just a different way to look at it. And that's what I like about Basque food, too. It's, like, a different way to look at Spain, like, sideways, like, through the Basque experience, mm-hmm. which is really different from that Moorish Jewish experience, which is not to say that there isn't a little bit of, like, you know, sort of impact from that in Basque cooking, but it's not that you're not looking, it's a completely different context and perspective. And so I was just trying to, for my own reasons, change the context in which I was looking at Spanish food so that I could contribute different things to my restaurant or my profession.
Yeah, it's a different, yeah. if it's a different story than the other restaurants tell.
They all have a real story, and mm-hmm. I like the storytelling part of making food. But also, but specifically, I wanted to just change the way I was looking at it, my perspective, to see if I could come up with new things.
Yeah, I do feel like your restaurants all are part of a story that, like, collectively, there might be one larger story that mm-hmm. all of them sort of tell together. Does it feel like that to you, or do they
yes.
all feel very distinct?
No, they do feel like part of a broader story about Spain that we wanted to tell, but in a very personal way, and that's why, yeah, all the restaurants are meant to coexist.
Oh, we have a question. bathroom? Yeah. You can ask David. The boy in the studio will show you where it is. Yeah. So I know that you've been asked about, like, what Basque food means to you, or like what it is, and it's hard, I'm sure, to kind of articulate, like, what exactly is Basque food, because it's so many things, but what is it to you?
To me, Basque food is one of them. It's sort of elusive, because I think everyone goes to the Basque Country and they love everything that they eat. But I don't think everyone could come back and just make, like, authentic Basque cuisine. I mean, it is a food that to me, or their cuisine is defined by a modesty and simplicity that I don't think most American chefs can deal with at all. Like, it would be, you have to kind of erase yourself from it. And if you erase yourself too much and then you don't execute it at a high enough level, then it has, then it's not important. It's hyper modest and all important all at once.
Yeah, and it is that conscious you're talking about. It's like the El Bulli and like all, you know, the Muguritz and all the Michelin starred restaurants, and then like it's just super simple. It's like an olive and an anchovy and a pepper.
Well, that's what I always describe as like being like these very simple ingredients that are incredibly elastic and flexible. But you really need to have, I think, a lot of skill and a lot of imagination to express those flavors in ways that are unique to yourself. And so it's like a very challenging food to make.
Yeah.
And that's why I think most Basque restaurants aren't serving Basque food. I don't mean that in the Basque country. Uh-huh. I mean here, like,
yeah,
self-defined Basque restaurants. Are serving Catalan dishes. I don't know why, because they think their patrons want them.
Yeah. So what was it like you wrote a cookbook about Basque food, which I imagine must have been a really overwhelming process.
That was really challenging, because I wanted it to be like truthful and honest and helpful and generous. But I also wanted it to have a story, like a beginning and an end, and to like, and I wanted somehow to convey like how personal the food at our restaurant is, even though it's Basque and it's a specific place,
yeah,
in the world, that it's about two places and two people who like met and sort of created this thing that's like very reverential to like to Basque cooks and Basque culture, and it has a very strong Basque identity, just like, you know, but it also but we also really like what we do, and I think we do it with like a lot of flair. But I didn't want it to be a restaurant cookbook. I wanted it to be something. I mean, what we do is in many of the dishes, even though we try to cast sort of a wide net over all the different ways you could eat in the Basque country, from high to low or low to high and everything in between. But a lot of the like the techniques that we have for developing like deep flavors and complex flavors out of very few ingredients, they come from home cooking. So it was like when we opened the restaurant, we took home cooking and we turned it into a restaurant. Then we had to kind of reverse engineer it back into the book, back into home cooking.
Yeah.
And so that was the challenge. And it was actually much easier to take home cooking and bring it to a restaurant than to do the other way around, I have to say.
Yeah.
I mean, just from...
And what was the process of kind of, like, organizing the book? Because there's so many different components to what Basque food is. Like, you write in the book, like, there's the pinchos, and then there's, like, the festivals and the cider houses. Did you always know it was going to be...
I knew it had to include, like, all those aspects. Like, for people to have an idea of, like, how to match the landscape to the food, to the people. Because the Basque people are central to, like... There's a lot of cuisines that I don't want to say they can exist outside of like the people, but like they're very vibrant and their flavor profiles and the palates are like very obvious, and they're like the flavors themselves are strong. In Basque food, the flavors are fairly delicate and usual. What's unusual is the strong cultural identity that like makes the dishes, supports the flavors, and that they continue to like sort of celebrate these simple, very minimalist preparations, sort of in spite of everything that's going on around them, like that they have persisted.
Yeah.
You know, because it'd be so easy to be adding a lot
Are you really happy with how the book came out?
I am really happy with how the book came out. I mean, whenever you do anything, you always think, I mean, for sure this is true in restaurants. I mean, a book is not like a restaurant where you get to, like, improve it every right. day and, like, see its defects. But I think it came up, very beautifully. And
it was the story that you wanted to tell.
It was the story that I wanted to tell, and it was, and it's honest.
Yeah. And so, it is very much a love letter.
Yeah.
Which is the best part of it. And it's so much about your love affair. I mean, not just with your husband and meeting your husband, but with the cuisine and the people and the landscape. And it's just very intimate and very lovely.
Oh, thank you. And restaurants. I mean, restaurants across the board. Which, I mean, the Basque Country has amazing restaurants at every level also. And, yeah, if you get a chance to visit... there's nothing not to love about that.
There's
like, you don't need to
delicious.
Go to Michelin star restaurants to, like, to experience, like, true Basque cooking.
Yeah. And, oh, do you have a question? Okay.
Mommy, when you go to the Basque Country, do you feel like, the food there relates to your food?
I do.
That's a really good question.
I do at the low level, and now I feel like even sort of at the high level, I think people are trying to uncomplicate things. For a while, they kept adding and adding and adding, and I think the building kind of fell over, and now everyone's getting back to sort of the more important flavors. Like, for a while, like, in high-end Basque restaurants, they were cooking, like, very internationally, and so they didn't have that much to do with what we were doing. But they can do that because they'll be Basque because they're there, whereas we would never do that. But I also never wanted to do it. And I like to go to the Basque Country and have really true Basque flavors. I'm happy to be able to do that again, even at the higher restaurant.
Yeah. And I would love to just touch on your new place, which I realized I pronounced wrong. So could you say it?
No, you said it right. Tekoa.
I said Tekoa. So, yeah.
Oh, but so Tekoa is actually a closer to the real pronunciation. It's a complicated...
Well, I just want to say it the way you say it.
I say Tekoa, but it really is Tekoa, like you said, because the name actually is from the Guarani, which are, like, a minority group from Argentina and Paraguay.
I thought it was Basque.
It's not. It looks like a Basque word, but it's not.
It does, yeah.
And it also apparently is a Hebrew word, mm-hmm. which I didn't know, that means trumpet, like, and it means, like, sort of like a call to gather. But Tekoa in the Guarani expression means, like, habitat.
And mommy.
Like, it's, like, where you are, what you are. It's, like, where you do, what you do. And because it was an all-day cafe, we wanted people to come and work and knit and do whatever they wanted
knit,
to do.
Knit, I love
whatever
that.
Whatever they wanted to do there.
Yeah, well, when I go there, my favorite thing to do there is eat, because the food is really, really delicious.
The food's tasty.
Yeah, it's incredible. And if I lived closer, I think I would be there all day, every
day.
Well,
you can go at night starting very soon. We're opening it at night, and we've been testing recipes.
And is it going to have a really different vibe than during the day?
Well, there's going to be a new mural on the back wall. Uh-huh. There's going to be, new, like, drinks and wines. And, yeah, it should be fun. I don't know that... I think the vibe will be determined by the people, because mm-hmm. it's a space made for the community, and whatever the community makes of it is what it will become. It's kind of blank slatey. It's very white.
Yeah.
But the food has a lot of personality, and it's stuff that you... It's stuff we've never made before to sell. Mm-hmm. How's that? Like, we've made it before for ourselves and for our staff. And
it's like the kind of food you want to eat in your home.
Yeah, and it's all very sort of like, yeah, there's like some Argentine things, there's some Mexican things, but it's not authentic to anything except for
what you
place.
Like.
Yeah.
Except for just being... super delicious, and the kind of food you'd want to eat every day.
Every day is the key.
Yeah.
And the flavors are, like, they're very easy to like, but there's something for everyone there. Yeah. And it's not, there's not a ton to pick from. You know, it's like 15 mm-hmm. dishes, so it's like, It's easy to go
it's
in
very
and like
unfussy
have a meal
and uncomplicated and, delicious.
Yeah,
and it's just the kind of place you can hang
so
out.
So far,
every
we're
day.
Trying not to. We're trying not to like get carried away, but it's so fun to like cook in all traditions.
Yeah.
That,
and it's just so. I mean, it's just mind blowing to me that you are constantly developing new projects. You have a book. You have a new place. You have a family. How do you do it? I mean, I know you get asked this question a lot, and it's probably really annoying.
Well, the answer is with difficulty. Mm-hmm. Sometimes not as well as others, and there is constant like neglect of something, even if it's just yourself or you're like you didn't like don't get to exercise the way you wanted to, or you don't get to pick up your kids at school every day. There's definitely a lot of compromises, but you know we're lucky and we're still trying to figure it out.
Yeah,
I think everyone's always trying to figure it out.
Yeah, for sure.
Like I mean. I don't know what my life is going to look like in 5 years at all.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with the morning after quiz.
Okay.
Back. This is the morning after on Heritage Radio, and I've been talking to Chef Alex Reich about all of her her lovely restaurants and her new book called The Basque Book that's out right now. But now we're gonna go off course a little bit because it is time for the morning after quiz, which will wrap up the show today. And Alex, so you know, the morning after quiz is an incredibly inconsequential quiz. It's three questions. They are all multiple choice. There'll be three answers to choose from. And it's going to be the least meaningful quiz that you've ever taken in your life.
Okay.
So each week, it's a different topic that somehow pertains to our guest. And my favorite thing that I tasted when I went to the Basque Country for the first time was the Gilda, which is an olive, an anchovy, and a pepper just stuck
perfect.
Together. Just perfect.
Perfect,
perfect combination.
Yeah.
And it's called a Gilda. Because the way that the anchovy and the olive and the pepper are shaped is it looks somewhat reminiscent of a woman's figure mm-hmm. when it's together on this little skewer. And it's actually named after a movie called Gilda that's a 1946 film noir movie starring Rita Hayworth, and that's where the name comes from. So that's what your quiz is going to be on today.
On that movie?
On that movie.
Oh my God, I don't think I've ever seen the movie.
Great.
Okay. I tell that story that you just told so many times. I was like, she's going to ask me who starred in the movie. I'm going to just nail it. I don't think I've ever seen the movie. If I have, it was with my older sister.
Once again, this is the least meaningful quiz you'll have taken in your entire life.
Maybe I did. Maybe you'll be like, yeah.
If you get an answer right, that's what happens. And if you don't, it's fine. It's fine too. Okay. Either way, it's totally fine. So, okay, first question. It's multiple choice. There's going to be three answers to choose from.
Okay.
What event occurred during the release of Gilda that made Rita Hayworth unspeakably angry? Was it A, after the movie was released, while it was playing, an atomic bomb was tested in the Pacific Ocean, and the bomb, while it was tested, actually had an image of Rita Hayworth kind of like superimposed onto it, and the word Gilda was stenciled onto the bomb in 2-inch black letters, and it was apparently a reference to the fact that Rita Hayworth was, in fact, a bombshell.
Uh-huh.
Was it number two, a nude photo of Rita Hayworth was published in Esquire magazine without her permission?
Mm-hmm.
It was used as part of a press campaign to promote the film. It was very scandalous because even though she wasn't entirely nude, the bikini top she was wearing was a little bit see-through.
Mm-hmm.
Or was it three, While Gilda was being filmed, Rita recorded the songs Amado Mio and put the blame on Mame for the movie. But when it was actually released, the song had been dubbed and recorded over by the singer Anita Kurt Ellis. Much to Miss Hayworth's embarrassment, she didn't know that someone else would be singing when she went and saw the movie. So what was it that made her unspeakably angry?
Oh, my God,
angry?
If I were her, any one of those three, can I just say all of the above? They would all piss me off.
But only one actually occurred.
I'm going to say number two.
The nude photo.
The nude photo, even though I also think, I feel like I know that she was like politically liberal and wouldn't like the bomb either.
It was the bomb.
It was the bomb.
Yeah.
Yeah, I knew that she would
Isn't
feel that,
crazy?
That way about the bomb.
But it just seems so weird that that happened. Like, our government made that decision to put an image of Rita Hayworth testing an atomic bomb.
It is completely crazy.
Yeah, it is very crazy.
But I think the reason I went for two was because I think I've seen a picture of her in the bikini, like, as publicity for
I think yeah. she knew about it, though, yeah, probably. Okay. I mean, I kind of made that up, but it's probably also,
no,
like,
I love
true.
That. I love that was the one. It's so crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Okay, number two. So what accident took place during the filming of Gilda? One, Rita Hayworth wore a corset for the first few weeks of filming because she'd recently given birth, so to make her appear thinner, and the corset was fastened so tightly that one day she actually passed out during a scene with her co-star Glenn Ford. Mm-hmm. Was it two, when in the movie she's brought back to Argentina. The movie takes place in Argentina. She sees her like ex-lover Johnny, and she slaps him across both sides of his face. But in reality, she smacked him so hard it broke two of his teeth. He stayed in place until the take was finished, though. Or number three. The movie, taking place in Argentina, largely focused on this character named Johnny, who was a crooked gambler. And in one scene, a gun prop that was fired turned out to be loaded. The actor, Glenn Ford, he narrowly avoided being shot by the gun prop that turned out to be a real gun, and the crew never figured out how a real gun with bullets managed to make it onto the set.
Oh, God. It's one or three. I'm going to say three.
It's a good guess, but it was actually two. She smacked him so hard in the film, she broke two of his teeth.
I love her more and more.
I know, but I think it's so amazing that he just held the take. He just like went with it. Okay, so originally Humphrey Bogart was offered the leading role of Johnny Farrell, but he did not take the role.
I think I knew that. I feel like I've, yeah.
Did he pass on it? Because A, him and Rita Hayworth famously did not get along because they had dated in the past, but she dumped him for Orson Welles. Was it two? He had also been offered the role of Rick Blaine in Casablanca, and he had to choose which film to star in. Or was it three? He reasoned that with, you know, the gorgeous Rita Hayworth as the star, audience wouldn't look at anybody else.
I'm going to say one.
It actually was three.
Yeah.
Yeah.
God, I didn't get a single one.
But that's okay. It doesn't even matter. You still did great, right? Give it up. And I want to thank you so much.
I learned a lot.
You learned some. Yeah, I made up some stuff. Hopefully that doesn't stick with you. Thank you so much for coming on. Congratulations on your beautiful book and new restaurant. And
Yay!
Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week with The Morning After on Heritage Radio.
Cool.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.